Cleaning starts. Start speaking.
Now you can speak. Hello? Can you hear me? Yes.
I have to go to your...
Ah, I was in the wrong folder.
This won't work.
No?
No, because you don't have write access.
That's not necessary.
This will work, yeah.
Yes.
This will work.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Friday of BitreichCon 2026. We are here in Femmøller in Denmark. The plural we, not the royal we, 20H and ADC.
Hello!
We are just settling in, and now it's time for my presentation on geospatial data, and in particular the tool QGIS, which is a very nice open source tool that we can get a lot of use out of. So my name is Anders Damsgaard, or ADC on Bitreich ISC. You can find me on the web and on Gopher. So I work now as a senior researcher at the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland. So it's a public position, public research institution, and also consultancy institution. So everything we are doing has to have a research angle to it and be for the greater good. So I'm within the field of groundwater mapping, geophysical methods and analysis, and geological modeling. And I'll come back to what these topics particular mean a bit later on. And Greenland as in Denmark, or Greenland is still Denmark, but the future is uncertain. We'll see what happens, but let's see if the Americans want to get to the Bitreich Arctic walls or not. I think it's not about the oil, it's about the meme cache up there. So part of my work is teaching geophysics to geological surveys and water authorities in developing countries, such as in Africa. So the motivation for what I'm talking about today is that Denmark has something called the Strategic Sector Cooperation from the Foreign Ministry, where it's about not transferring money directly to foreign countries, because that can end up in the wrong hands in some cases. So instead of transferring money, we want to transfer knowledge and expertise and also experience both ways, because it's also very ill-posed to go in with your outside worldview and think you can change everything in a country without knowing the local conditions. So it's very important for the project's success in these initiatives that you have a local partner and a local knowledge exchange. So I am affiliated with the water track. So there are different tracks within this cooperation, and water is about drinking water and drinking water supply. And what Denmark is really good at internationally is producing geophysical instruments for finding and mapping groundwater. And these instruments, they measure things on the Earth's surface or above the Earth's surface. So everything is tied to a point in space. So that's what we call geospatial data, because the data is connected to some coordinates. And these instruments, they are developed usually by small companies here in Denmark at least. And they are also kind of niche products. You won't sell many thousands of these, but maybe up to 1,000. So each copy is very expensive, something like 50,000 euros and up. And what the Danish industry then has built on top of this is a software stack to further leverage this market. And these software stacks were built for when the Danish groundwater mapping program was happening over the past 30 years. So it's again aimed at a very small market, but also priced accordingly. So the problem is when you take these very specialized instruments and send them abroad and expect them to use very specialized pieces of proprietary software, the tools and the results might get used while the programs are running, but as soon as the funding stops, then maybe the data will sit on a server somewhere and never be touched again. So that's where open source tools should come into play, because if it's open source, everybody owns it and everybody can adapt it and develop it to their own needs. Yeah, so it's priced like medical devices for sure, and it's a shame. You could say that the economy of the instruments is not enough to sustain this development. So all of the produced data, for instance, when we go to countries in this cooperation and measure geophysical data, the resultant data is given to the countries that we're partnering with, and the initiative is funded by development aid and is used for mapping these groundwater resources, mainly for drinking water, but also for irrigation of fields and so on. So yeah, 20H is writing the point. Some doctors donated computer tomography devices to Guatemala. They rotted at the harbor. There were no technicians, no radiologists, no producer for the radioactive isotopes. That's a great example, because the equipment and like medical devices in this example, they're only part of the infrastructure that you need. You also need the expertise and the know-how and everything surrounding the use. So that's what we need to work on, and what this talk is about. So the proprietary visualization tools that we have for these instruments, they typically all have a GIS core, so a geographical information system core, which has things like geometry types and coordinate transformations, but more or less a standard GIS core. And then for the data that these instruments produced, it typically has some specialized 2D or 3D views to show the geophysical data on top of other maps that you might have in the area. So you typically need a map view where you see the area that you're working on from above, or you might, in the case of groundwater and geology, you want to have looks into the subsurface. And that could be like depth transects along a line. So imagine that you take a vertical cut along a section of the earth, and then you look at it from the side. That would be such a view. Or in some cases, people also use three-dimensional views with these like OpenGL primitives. But 3D views is mostly when you get into working with this data, they're mostly like a flashy things. A flashy view that you use to impress people and politicians and common men, because it's not something that is practical to work with. So it's much more common to use depth transects that you then move back and forth in space. So in my opinion, the GIS core of these programs is really the hard part. That's really difficult. All of the geophysical data rendering and so on, that's easy compared to that. And secondary, all of these proprietary tools, they are Windows only, and they typically bundle some old version of like an Access database, and they then invent their own GIS because that's what they think is right. So that's of course a problem. Yeah, it's Windows only, like medical device software, because that's the biggest market, and with a small niche product, you need to aim at the biggest markets. So GS is not easy. One example is coordinate reference systems, and there is something called EPSG codes, which are unique identifiers for coordinate reference systems. So basically, a coordinate reference system is a way of understanding where a coordinate within that system is actually placed on Earth. So this is a way of, for example, translating a latitude or longitude into a different system, which could, for example, not be degree, but meter-based. So you might have heard of UTM, coordinate reference systems, universal transcoordinate maps. And they are typically smaller zones, because if you stretch something which is rectilinear and meter based over large distance, of course, the curvature of the Earth will become a problem. So you tend to have local UTM zones where the meter scale is more or less correct. And in one of these big open source coordinate reference system libraries called PROSH, there are no less than 11,000 coordinate reference systems. So when you develop software, you either need to pick and choose what reference systems you use, or you link against a library such as this one. But there are many ways to get coordinates wrong. A simple example is if you get the axis wrong, the axis order wrong. So, for example, the EPSG 4326, which is latitude, longitude, is latitude and then longitude. But most implementations internally use longitude and then latitude. And GeoJSON, which is a format we'll come back to, also mandates longitude and then latitude. So again, if you use libraries, you can't do it wrong. But if you implement things yourself, then you can definitely get it wrong. Evil Bob mentions in the Netherlands, we have some specific coordinate system for some systems. And yeah, there are so many coordinate reference systems, and for good reason. And also traditionally, when you were still triangulating things optically and developing maps from the ground, you would have local systems. For example, when one of the big bridges was built here in Denmark, they made a coordinate reference system just for that bridge. Because if you scale down the coordinate reference system, it will have locally a higher precision. So yeah, it's at least to some extent, it would be easier if you always used latitude, longitude, because that has exact precisions. But it doesn't beat the convenience of sometimes working with meters for finding distances and so on, and polygon areas and whatnot. And a different complication, and that is, of course, a global issue, because we live on a planet which is tectonically active, and the plates, they move. Some of these coordinate systems, they are fixed to some of the tectonic plates, like ETRS 89, which is fixed to the Eurasian plate. So the coordinate system moves along with it, and other systems don't. So that means that these coordinate systems diverge by 2.5 centimeters per year. And of course, that divergence grows over time. So that will be a complication when you transform between the two. That was X and Y. Of course, there's also a vertical component, and the Z in a three-dimensional coordinate requires that you have some kind of reference surface, vertically speaking. And you can think of the Earth in different ways. You can either think of it as an ellipsoid, like a sphere that you squeeze on the poles. And actually, the Earth is more or less like that. So it's wider at the equator than it is at the poles. And that's because of the rotation flings out the mass of the Earth towards the side. Like, imagine a fat person as a ballerina or something like that. An ellipsoid is not the worst approximation, but the problem is that the Earth is heavier some places than others, and it's bumpy and so on. So we have instead a more complex Earth model, which is called the geoid. And that's this strange shape, which, for example, takes into account that the Earth is many meters lower in the Indian Ocean, for example, because India crashed into Himalaya, and that's very dense. So And there are different reference systems also for the height. So that's also something that you need to be able to include in your GS implementation. And as an example, if you get the vertical reference system wrong, then it's many meters that you can be mistaken by. So if you mix that, then you're going to be in problems. And also, it's also worth noting that there is no single elevation value. Elevation is also always relative to something. So that could be relative to the ellipsoid or the geoid or relative to the center of the Earth if you want to take it to the extreme. So the Earth height also changes over time. Here towards the poles, like here in Scandinavia, we have post-glacial rebound because 20,000 years ago we had kilometers of ice above us, and the Earth is like a memory pillow, a foam memory foam pillow or mattress, and it's still slowly bulging upwards and remembering the weight of the ice sheet. And in some cases here in some places, it's here in Scandinavia still rising by up to a centimeter a year, and in places outpacing the global sea level rise. So that's also something that you need to take into accordance if you go and have some fixed points for your reference systems. But again, yeah, the main message which you can guess is that it doesn't make sense to reinvent all of this handling of these niche cases and complications, but use libraries and use free and open source tools for everything available. So let's get back to the SSC work and this strategic partnering that we do with the developing countries. So in many places in the world, of course, drinking water is an issue, and also water for irrigation of farmland and so on. And groundwater is a really good resource because it's drought resilient. It doesn't dry out like surface lakes and so on during dry periods. But it's harder to see. You can't just send your eyes down there and see where it is. You always have to use more or less complex approaches in case you want to be systematically successful. Of course, that's not how it always happens. You can have some more or less knowledgeable person that just guesses where the water might be, or often things are just drilled by experience and so on, but you don't know if you are going to hit water, and also you don't put yourself in a position where you're able to predict if what you extract is going to be sustainable compared to the recharge of the aquifer system. And also you can depending on the aquifer setting end up in a case where boreholes cannibalize each other, so you draw water away from one borehole by establishing a new one. In order to get around that, you need to understand what the recharge is and how quickly water flows in between the earth layers. So Denmark has, and actually Aarhus University has developed a methodology and a set of instruments which is very good at using physics, look into the ground or scan the subsurface without having to do boreholes alone. Because boreholes are very, very expensive and time consuming, and they also need a geologist on site in order to make correct interpretation of what you see on the surface. So the proper way, or at least the way that was very successful in Denmark for mapping groundwater, and also the Netherlands, if I could add, is to do the occasional borehole, so you have some hands-on knowledge with the materials, and then do geophysics in between, so you understand the the three-dimensional geometry of the subsurface in between these borehole direct observations. So you basically combine the direct knowledge with the indirect knowledge from geophysics. Within this strategic sector cooperation, instruments are sponsored to these countries, and then training goes along within these development programs. But again, the very tail end of this pipeline from data collection to data processing to data analysis and producing groundwater models, the last parts there, the analysis and so on, requires this expensive software, which have annual licensing proceeds with expensive prices. So training 20 people requires 20 licenses or a shared machine, which is not scalable at all. And then when these development projects end, licenses expires and the data ends up being unused, and that is not very satisfying at all. So within this knowledge exchange, we need open formats because that's going to determine if the work will continue afterwards. So just a brief introduction to the geophysical method, which is based on transient electromagnetics. So it's electromagnetic waves that are used here. So you probably know about the experiment of Hans Christian Ørsted, a Dane, who took a copper wire and with some coils and put a compass next to it. A compass next to it. And when he turned on and off a current through the copper wire, he saw that the compass was changing direction ever so slightly. And that's because you can induce an electromagnetic field with current, and that's of course also the basis for electric motors and generators and whatnot. So it's the same principle within geophysics, and what you practically do is that you put out a loop of a piece of wire on the Earth's surface. And that would typically be 3 by 3 meters if you do it manually on the Earth's surface, or 40 by 40 meters if you are less worried about mobility of the system. Or there are also airborne systems where these loops are flown in the sky, slung from a helicopter. That's called SkyTEM. So TEM is transient electromagnetics. And that carries a 40 by 40 meter loop underneath it in a bamboo frame. And that's bamboo because the frame itself cannot be conductive. Because you want to observe this transient electromagnetic signal, not from the frame, of course, but from the subsurface. So after you've laid out this wire loop, you turn on a current in the loop and then you turn it off. And then you have a very a corresponding receiver coil where you then listen for the induced signal which comes back from the surroundings. So the surroundings can be everything. It can be the ground underneath, but of course it can also be an electric metal structure close by, like a metal house or fence or power line or whatever. So you need to be away from those artificial structures for this to be isolated to the ground signal. So after you've turned off the current, this ring-shaped induced field will then propagate upwards and downwards. And it's a downward signal that we're interested in. And that widens downwards like a cone with 60 degrees. So you basically have something like a smoke ring which propagates downwards. And what you receive in the coil and surface is going to be then the response from each depth over time. So later time will be deeper depths, but it'll also be a signal that represents a larger volume because this smoke ring has widened in area. So the resolution basically drops and also the signal drops. So So with more modern instruments, they've gotten better and better at making deep scans. So this collapsing induced fields induces currents in the ground, and then they get received by the coil on the surface. And what controls the magnitude of this signal that you see on the surface is the resistivity or the conductivity of the ground. So imagine that you have something like salt water in the subsurface. You can put two electrodes into salt water and you can transport current. So salt water is very conductive. That means that it has a very low resistivity, and the units for resistivity are ohm times meter. So it's basically the resistance you would get over a meter of material. So the resistivity is going to control how much material how much signal you get back over time. So if you have a very high resistivity on top, that does, for example, hard rock, something which has no water in it, something like a dense crystalline rock, that would have a very high resistivity. It would be very hard to conduct anything through it. And maybe you have some water underneath it that would have a comparingly lower resistivity. So that contrast is something you would be able to see by this change in signal over time. So the measurement would be something like this, typically shown in log-log space. So the horizontal axis would be log time. So the later time would be deeper depth. And the vertical axis would be the strength of the decay of the electromagnetic signal. So that just has a natural decay because of this widening of the signal. But if there's something that is very conductive in the ground, that causes the decay to be slower because it provides a stronger signal back. But these gates, they are very the instruments basically measure the return signal in gates over time, something like 20, 30, maybe up to 50 gates that are listening gates over time. And the better the instrument, the earlier gates it can resolve and then get a fine resolution at the very surface. And a good instrument would also be having very sensitive gates at late time to get the very weak signal from deep depths, so you can get a good deep view into the subsurface. And yes, it is pretty much like an MRI. So it's where you again, MRI would actually also in the view of some correspond to some kind of geophysical method. And ultrasonic scans, I suppose, would also qualify for this. And yes, we also use satellites for sure, remote sensing, because that is a very good way of seeing the spatial patterns without going there. And in particular, it's very good at redrawing old geological maps because you can see some of the divisions that people 40, 50 years have seen on the Earth's surface. You can now see them from space. Yes, so this plot shows what is measured, and that is what is measured many, many times. So you basically move this loop on the ground surface or you fly through the air. In Kenya, we flew it for 4,500 kilometers underneath a helicopter, and we have tons of this data that we really want to get the most out of. Because a city like Nairobi is growing by a lot, and some of the aquifer water levels are dropping by more than 80 meters over 10 meters, 10 years. So 10 years and 80 meters of water level drop, that's catastrophic. Yeah. So the instruments measure observed decay. We do some magic. And then we get to a model of ground resistivity against depth. So like in MRI, where you get density in space or along a transect. So we typically assume a layered model, and then we compute the decay it would produce. So instead of directly translating the observed decay into a resistivity versus depth, we take kind of a Monte Carlo approach. We come up with many likely resistivity versus depth scenarios, and then we loop through them, and then we find the one which is most closely resembling what we observe. And of course, there are many, many tricks to doing this efficiently, but that's basically the principles behind it. And so that's brute force inversion. But the problem is ill-posed, because there can be several models which fit the same data, the same observations equally well. So here is an example of this non-uniqueness. So imagine two sections. So imagine that the ground is on the surface and the layers here are representing a vertical sequence. So in these two models, model A and model B, we both have 30 ohmmeters at the very top for 20 meters thickness. But then there is either 2 ohmmeters for 5 meters or 1 ohmmeter for 10 meters. And that would be equivalent when you do the inversion. So you can get around this non-uniqueness by having many measurements in the vicinity, and also an understanding, for example, from boreholes of what you expect in the area. So again, a methodology like this is not by itself a solution to anything, but it's a way in combination of other things making it possible to make an integrated analysis that you can then use your expert knowledge to say something of. Yes. With the inversion, there's also calculated something called the depth of investigation, and that's basically a limit to what you can actually resolve, because the inversion software will not tell you if the results are actually trustworthy or not. If it's asked to produce results onto, say, 500 meters of depth, it will do that, but you need a different quantity to actually make sure, can we actually resolve to 500 meters of depth? So that's where this depth of investigation comes in. I believe in something like ultrasonics, you have principles of skin depth. It's basically when you have a wave equation, there's a decay, a characteristic decay, and to some 30, I think 37% of the decay, that's what you call the skin depth, where you have lost some kind of resolving power. So this DOI, this depth of investigation, marks where you actually can see something, and then it's good practice to cut away the results that you cannot trust, because otherwise people will just blindly trust the results and make wrongful interpretations off of that. So the DOI is typically, together with these resistivity models, also treated as a geometry. And 20H says, in ultrasound, you always have the doctor expert controlling the signal. And yeah, that's exactly it. You cannot be a novice user and get meaningful results out of it. You have to have the correct background knowledge, because it's very dangerous just to interpret without you knowing something about the methodology and something about the circumstances of that measurement. So the current state is that we need this proprietary software by these companies that try to increase the profit by selling the software which goes along with the instrumentation. But this really acts on a negative feedback on on how much these tools spread, because the software will be the limiting factor. And also, just using this kind of proprietary software is against the mindset of force-minded people. It also leads to closed centralized development. So if something doesn't work, or you get a new data type of something, then you have to email some guy that sits in another country, and maybe they have a ticketing system and they don't know what your system is like, and so on. And you can imagine all the headaches that come with it. And because these are niche markets, like I guess medical instruments are, it means high pricing and limited support because it's not feasible for the companies to have big support staff. So it's typically out of budget for occasional users. So it limits the spread of knowledge and methodology. We do not have to fill out a paper form typically, but close. I guess you have an email template or something like that. Yes. So, as I said, for the TEM data, the transient electromagnetics, the like with other things, the GIS is the hard part. The visualization of geophysical data is much simpler than that. So we can actually just use OpenGS tools that already are established, and then we can transform the geophysical data into something that these tools can show. And if the built-in methodology in the OpenGS tools is not sufficient, then because it's open source software, we can expand it. And in some cases, there are even plugin systems that makes it easy to expand these systems. So the workflow is that we transform the data from whatever format they are in, like binary formats or SQL dumps. Sometimes the softwares also have direct ASCII export, which is of course a huge win. So of course ASCII plain text has a lot of benefits that work with the Unix philosophy. So we need to represent the applicable data as geospatial primitives. And one way of doing that is through the well-known text format, WKT. With that, we store numerical data in flat ASCII files, and that's what the Open Geospatial Consortium also concluded in 1999. So I guess they've been listening to some of the inspiring thoughts of the Unix people. So, as I said, fortunately, some of these instruments that we use have a text export, so then we can skip the binary reverse engineering. And we're really happy that this text export is there because I think it's usually intended for people to import into Excel spreadsheets. At least it's formatted that way, or perhaps debugging. But it's for the most part a little bit of a strange format. It has its own conventions. Each piece of software has its own ASCII format, its own header fields, its own definitions, its own dummy values. Sometimes it has metadata on what coordinate reference systems you're using. Sometimes it doesn't, and then you have to guess. Yeah, it's a bit of a mess, but it's basically geologists coming up with data science concepts, and that's not always a pretty sight. But you typically have resistivities and thicknesses that you want to have as a geological result. And sometimes you have these gate values that I talked about, which represents this decay of the electrical field. Yeah, it looks kind of like PostScript. I agree on that. They call it the XYZ format. So far, I have worked with two vendors, and between them, they have three different dialects, but it all stems from the same physics. It's just different companies. The comment lines start with a slash. In most of the variants, there is missing data by 9,999 or 99,999. Or minus 990, no, sorry, 9,999, 999, basically. And then it has a data model where you have column names, add also uncertainty for each column and then thickness for each column. So if you have 35 layers of resistivity in your model, you end up with 105 columns. It's fixed width. I've also seen printf mistakes, whereas whoever wrote the printf implementation didn't realize that if you have a float with more digits than the width of the fields, then you collide the fields. So you don't necessarily have a white space in between different values. So that was a stupid one. Yeah, as I mentioned, the coordinate reference system is sometimes given, sometimes not. Yeah, but this is because they expect people to work with this in spreadsheets. But parsing is more or less straightforward once you can decrypt these different variants. Okay, back to the well-known text format. These are geospatial primitives. They are very simple, very good, and this is how we can transform this strange format into something which is universally readable. And the geospatial primitives that we have are listed here. That's all of them. We have two-dimensional primitives and we have three-dimensional primitives. So the first one would be something like a point, x and y. You can also have a 3D point, which would be a point z, which would have an x, y, and z value. You could have a line string, which would be an x, y, or a series of x, y pairs. You can have a polygon, which is again many coordinates which mark the outline of the polygon, and then there's the rule that the first and last values have to be the same, so the polygon ends. You can have these multi types which have several polygons or several points or several line strings in them, or you can have geometry collections which have even further collections of subtypes. And that's it. That's all of it. So anything that can be shown on a map is one of these types. And here is a link to the standard as described by the Open Geospatial Consortium. Yeah, 28 says, why don't you move X and Y in position to confuse further like incursus does? Yes, great idea. And that's the same as this lat long confusion. So we can we can write a parser for these XYZ files that we get out from the software, and then we can do a simple printf and transform the coordinates into something which these geospatial pieces of software like GS programs or geospatial databases just natively read and understand. So it's very simple. This is how you make a point. This is how you make a three-dimensional point. You can implement this everywhere, and you can make this efficient or as lazy as you want. And the way that we then turn this geophysical data, which was these layers of resistivity at depth, into a geospatial representation is that we take the coordinates at the Earth's surface at the very top of a line string, and then we keep the x and y, which are the horizontal coordinates, fixed, and then we walk downwards in the z, the vertical coordinate, or z downwards, and then that three-dimensional line, which is pointing directly downwards, we direct that downwards with depth, which corresponds to this penetration of this electromagnetic signal. And then, along with each segment of this line string, we tie together this resistivity value that we were so interested in. Because remember, the resistivity was informing us about the conductivity of the Earth, or it basically informs us about what kind of geological material is there. If we have water, which would have a low resistivity, or if it would have a high resistivity, which would be a dry rock, like a crystalline layer on aquifer without water in it. So that's the way that we can see the water and also represent the water, the geology in a three-dimensional sense. So we typically plot these as fence diagrams, and that is basically just many of these vertical lines shown next to each other in a depth transect. So like if you do a scan of a belly with an ultrasonic device, like 20H has in his doctor toolkit, you also see your results along a line or like a picture seen from the side. And this would be the same, just with these vertical lines that drape downwards. So each sounding, each place on the Earth's surface would be represented by a vertical set of line string Z segments, while you then typically color it by the resistivity. And then you have some standard color scales, so people have a conceptual understanding of just visually understanding what you have in the subsurface. So when you have many of these points on the Earth's surface, they form a section. So that could look like this, where here the different ASCII characters represent different resistivities. So of course you can implement this data transformation in any way you want, even in Org or in Bash or whatever. It's not difficult. You just write something like point Z's or line string Z for this. And the same well-known text string is understood by PostGIS, which is a geospatial extension for PostgreSQL. It's widely used. It's a very good extension to use as soon as you have geospatial data, because it makes geospatial indexes and hierarchical indexes, which makes it very quick to access data for a given area, and much faster than a regular Postgres table would be able to. And in addition to that, it also provides functionality. So for example, you can give it a polygon and then ask it to return all of the records in a geospatial table that are within that polygon or within a distance of it, within a buffer distance, for instance. So that's Postgres and PostGIS. There's also Spatial Light, which also understands the same syntax. There's the GDAL, the Geographical Data Abstraction Library, which has drivers for understanding this text format. And also most web map libraries also know this format. So it's universally used and applicable. Evil Bob asks, is a double typically precise enough? And yes, I would say so. I haven't encountered cases where it wouldn't be. But of course, it also depends on what coordinate reference system that you use. So if you use something like lat-long, this global coordinate reference system, and you work on very small data areas and so on, then the precision might not be enough. But if you use a more localized coordinate reference system, then the precision might be there. So it depends a little bit on the case. Yeah, exactly as Evil Bob says, Spatial Light, that's an extension for SQLite. So you might have also heard of GeoJSON. That's what all the web hipsters use. So WKT is the text grammar, and GeoJSON is the same data model in JSON. So this point Z example would translate to something like a GeoJSON structure like this. And actually, GeoJSON is a very nice format. I really like it because you can have this inherent flexibility in the data model. So if your instrument all of a sudden produces a new kind of additional measurement or something like that, then you can just add it to the data structure without any parsers breaking if you've written them properly. So it's really nice with a flexible data structure like this. So there's an RFC for GeoJSON, and there's lossless round tripping with WKT because it's just ASCII text. And the RFC mandates a single coordinate system with global coordinates, longitude and then latitude. But in GeoJSON, I've also often seen the local coordinate reference system added on as an extra field, so you still have the native precision when you need it, and then you can use the lat long for your WebGIS implementation and so There's also something called GeoPackage, which is basically just an SQLite file that you give a new extension, GPKG. But it's just an SQLite file, which with a geospatial index, and you can query it, and it's binary. So of course, it's way faster and more space efficient on your disk if you have huge data sets. But WKT and GeoJSON would be the plain text formats that have benefits if that's your use case. 20H asks, how many coordinates systems can you transpose in your head without a computer? The answer is zero. Okay, so we talked about vector data. That's geometry with coordinates. And of course, the other type of geospatial data is rasterized data, a grid of values with a known position where you have a regular grid, so you don't need explicitly to tie a coordinate to every single measurement. So the vectors basically for each measurement or each entity you must prescribe the whole location, whereas in a raster it would be by indexing a grid, and the raster itself would just prescribe some value. So rasters are typically used if you have something like a surface elevation model, like a digital elevation model, or maybe you have satellite imagery, like visible imagery or multi-spectral imagery beyond the visible spectrum. Maybe you have geophysical grids, seismic data, or how the Earth moves, or maybe the reflectivity of the Earth's surface is like, which could be dependent on the soil moisture and so on. And scanned maps are, of course, another example. If you have an old geological map and you scan that, you can transform that into something which is actually tied to a point in space and not to a point on an A4 page. So this plugin, and now I'm going to wait with that part a little bit and talk about GeoTIFF, which is a really cool hack. So the TIFF image format goes back to 1986, and it's a container of tagged records, and the tag space is extensible. In 1986, yeah, that was a good year. I was born that year also, and Chernobyl blew up, so I think the radioactive contribution to the atmosphere started a lot of good things. GeoTIFF and Bitreich members. But in GeoTIFF, a guy called Niels Ritter in 94 added some new tags, some header tags, which include everything that you need for making this raster image grid into something which has a position in space. And that's by adding some private TIFF tags. And the result is that you have a georeference image that still is a completely valid TIFF. You can open it in whatever TIFF program that you have. It's still a valid TIFF. Maybe the raster values look a bit strange. They could represent meters above sea level and not RGB colors from 0 to 255 or whatever. They would typically be gray or something like that, single band gray if it's something like an elevation raster. But they can also be visible imagery like satellite images and so on. But with these tags, they are also representing points in space. And then you can use something like the Geographical Data Abstraction Library command line tools like getL info to get this metadata out of it. And UTIFF has spread because existing TIFF readers kept working, and in your programs, when you want to work with or when you want to support GeoTIFF, you just need a TIFF library and you read the correct headers, and then you're good to go. So it's very simple. It's just a simple coordinate transformation to get from these six header tags into a point in space. So you take your column number and your row number, and you multiply that with the given values, and then you get your point in world coordinates. So that's very, very cool. And here's a simple way of getting the pixel size or the spatial resolution of the grid that you might have. So if you have something like a DM model, it's very easy to get the resolution in this file just by querying the tags. Yes, and of course you can also use all kinds of compression and tiling and things that the TIFF format supports. There's also something called a cloud-optimized GeoTIFF, and that's because it's actually quite a cool trick, because you can put a multi-gigabyte TIFF file on a web server, but through this cloud optimization, the client would know just to ask for the specific area of interest within this file and make the selective data transfer from the web server. So what a cloud optimized GeoTIFF is that it's internally tiled rather than striped. So striped would be row by row by row or column by column by column. But it would be tile by tile by tile instead, because that helps with the indexing, because you typically want neighboring values rather than just something along whatever way the raster is oriented. A cloud-optimized GeoTIFF also contains internal downsampled pyramids, so lower resolution values of your big image, because if your WebGIS client just ask for an overview image of the entire Netherlands, it doesn't need the full resolution, so it gets the downsampled image instead. And it is a documented layout with the header first, so the client can read the header and then make the appropriate request. So this is a way of making a cloud-optimized GeoTIFF with the GDAL tools. And so you have an in-TIFF and you make a cloud-optimized out-TIFF. With this tool, you can also add some Z standard compression and make this cloud optimization with a predictor. And then you can serve this just via a static HTTP server and with the right query, make the client navigate this header and then get the right offset for this return. So there's also something called VRT. I forget what it stands for, but it's basically a huge XML file, which you can generate if you have a bunch of TIFF files, GeoTIFF files, or cloud-optimized GeoTIFF files. And it's an index which describes everything which would be available for the client. Then as the first request, the client can traverse this VRT file and figure out what TIFF file it actually needs to access. So basically, just to recap, a cloud-optimized GeoTIFF makes one raster efficient to read, especially over HTTP, and a VRT makes many rasters appear as one unified dataset. Okay, GDAL ships with a lot of really nice command line tools for rasters. There is like a GDAL rasterize where you can take vector data sets and turn them into rasters. You can turn rasters into vectors, like if you have Say a raster, you can turn that into many points instead. You can make contours, like if you have an elevation map, you can make contour maps instead. Yeah, my light just changed. That's because it's 9 o'clock. I'll change a config file in a few moments. And you can make all kinds of nice products like hill shape maps and so on. So the open geospatial stack is the Prosh library, which has all of these coordinate reference systems. It's C. And there's the Geos library, which was a port of an older Java topology suite, which has geometry predicates and is C++. And then there's GDEL, and that has all of the format translation that we just discussed. There's libtiff, of course, because GeoTIFF is just a TIFF. You will often use SQLite to read geo packages because that's just a SQLite database. And of course, QGIS is a very nice user interface for working with this kind of data. And QGIS was founded or had its first release in 2002. It's GPL licensed and C++ and Qt for the UI, and it has a Python API for extension and modification. And just a side note that the commercial GIS products usually link at exactly the same libraries. So the differentiation is mostly in the UI. So just some quick examples of what you can do with the OGR to OGR tool, which is also part of the GDEL data set. So it's a nice way of inspecting something like a geo package. It can also convert between formats, so maybe a shapefile, which is this garbage format coming from something called ArcGIS, which is it's a joke. Each data set comes with five files. You can only have 10 character ASCII characters or NC characters in your column names. And there's also, I think, a limit of 20,000 records in each file. It's a garbage format. But OGR to OGR makes it very easy to convert between these formats and bring these legacy files to a modern format. It can also reproject when you do this conversion, which is also very handy for these coordinate reference system codes. And when you have something like a geo package file, you can just query it with SQLite because it was just a database internally. So, for example, if you had a lot of these geophysical soundings and you want just the ones with the low resistivity, you can select the ones where your resistivity values are less than 10 ohm meters and then store that as the clay geo package. So it's very easy and hackable. Yes. Just an overview of this stupid shapefile format. That's still the default export in most of the software, but it's idiotic. Good. On to QGIS. As I said many times, QGIS is the hard part, so let's use some free and open source JS platform and expand it for our good purposes of widening these geospatial and geophysical tools for the purpose of drinking water mapping. So the newest release is QGIS 4, which was a nice kind of chore release because it got rid of a lot of old API legacy. So it cleaned up the API quite considerably. So it's easier now to make plugins and just support QGIS 4. And many plugins are half the size when they're tailored at just QGIS 4. But it's internally also more efficient at making many operations. So this tool that I wrote is called TM Loader. It has just three simple Python files in it. So QGIS has a built-in plugin manager, and a plugin repository where you can send in your plugin, and then that is going through automated and manual review before it is published for everyone within this repository. And this TM loader for this geophysical data was then accepted there. And one of the requirements is that it should not depend on other Python packages. But of course, you know, Python, you can include anything and then just include other packages within your package root, and just have an internal dependency tree within the repository. But if you do that, then you're very unlikely to get it accepted in this public plugin repository, because if you keep it Python only and with the Python packages that QGIS already includes, then anybody can just press install and not worry further about it. And in this plugin, there's the core functionality, which does this data transformation, the simple XYZ conversion to well-known text primitives, and then it stores it as a geo package, so it's quick for the renderer to work with. Then there's a separate file for the Qt dialogs, so it's easy for the user to work with this data. And then there is some few extra add-ons that are nice to have as a user. I kept the core file without any QGIS dependencies, so it can still be used just as it is without any QGIS needs. So if you don't want to have any UI, you can just run it on the command line. So this is the link to the plugin in the QGIS plugin repository. At present, it has over 1,000 installs around the world, which is very nice for such a niche product, because you basically need the instrument or a copy of the data that comes from such an instrument to be able to use it. So I'm quite surprised by how quickly it has spread. But I've spoken to users, of course, here in Denmark, but also in Kenya, where I have worked, in Morocco, in Ethiopia, in Ukraine, in France. So it's really nice to see that when there is a genuine need for such a tool, people are very happy to have it at their disposal. And this has 10 votes. Yes, 10 votes. So that's very nice. So go in and like and subscribe if you listen to this. So I think I'd like to close this with something which is very bitreichy, which is the Unix principles and application of the Unix principles, because small is beautiful. Making something like this as a small project that makes it nice and maintainable and hackable, so people around the world can adapt it and make new things with it and break it and build it and so on. So this was designed to do one thing and do it well, and other plugins that I wrote then work with other parts of the workflow that people need. So in this case, it's parse, style, and render. It's portability, because text is what's behind it. It uses ASCII and all of this. And it uses software leverage instead of inventing everything. We tap into the FOSS stack. And the plugin is optional. If you want to do command line stuff, you can do that. So that's also very Unixy. So in summary, vendor lock-in in science is often a file format problem. We get some mysterious file format, and the hindrance to adoption is working with this data and making value out of it. And within this SSC program, we want the most value, which is adoption, not economy. So writing the parser here was very easy. It took a weekend or so to figure this out and write it up. And with this universal WKT format and so on, we are done with the vector side and the geospatial data representation. And with GeoTIFF, we have the raster side covered. So coordinate reference systems remain the main source of error. And some of the surveys that get imported into this software, they will end up being plotted in the middle of the ocean because someone put in the wrong reference system when they measured it. And that's, of course, still the problem. So manual control is, of course, necessary. And as we also discussed with 20H along the way, expert knowledge is actually needed to make good use of these results. So thanks for listening. Happy to take any questions. Thank you for the questions along the way. I tried to answer some of them along the way, but maybe I didn't catch all of them. So in case I missed anything or you have further questions, just let me know. I will keep the stream open a little bit for the audio delay, but otherwise I would like to thank you again. Twenty says, do geologists play their hometown on Counter-Strike Go? Not that I know of, but my first job in 7th grade was making Counter-Strike maps for my science teacher who wanted his countryside house in Counter-Strike Go. And that was actually a fun entry to understanding 3D representations of things and how tesselation and 3D meshes can be a pain to work with. QGIS to Counter-Strike map. Yes, that sounds like a very good goal. And maybe that would get me to 2,000 installs. That would be something. And QGIS to Polytrack map. Yes, good idea also. Good idea also. Yes. Okay, I will end it here.
Thank you
very much and have a good night.